Hello everyone, and welcome to today's Austrian Wine Time Masterclass with Leo Hillinger, represented tonight by Paul Richtsteuer. My name is Antoinette Londeschon from Cork and Fork in Washington, D.C. We are a premium wine store founded by a multi-generational flying winemaker originally from Champagne, France. I'm delighted to introduce today's producer, Leo Hillinger Wines. In 1990, Leo Hillinger took over his father's wine business. His extensive structural reform and the purchase of premium vineyard sites propelled the Hillinger brand into being the internationally recognized and celebrated winery it is today. Passion, ideas, and especially energy are words used to describe Leo Hillinger. Leo is represented this evening by Paul Richtsteuer. Paul has been responsible for exports and key account customers at the Leo Hillinger Winery for almost 2 years now. For those joining us live, we'd love to hear from you. Place your questions in the Q&A and we will get to them time allowing. Since our guests are joining us live from Austria, quite a few hours ahead of us here in the United States, we will move immediately into the presentation. First, we will pass the mic over to Klaus Wittauer, owner of KW Selections, importer of some of the finest wines of Austria for more than the past two decades. Klaus, whenever you're ready.
Well, thank you, Antoinette, and welcome, Paul. And today I'm going to start out this session with a nice little video to get us right into the Burgenland Leiterberg region, which Nick, I think you are on mute right now. If you bring this video up, make sure you put yourself on speaker so we can hear this beautiful music and get us into the Leiterberg region, Burgenland.
Cross your fingers, here we go.
Our unique location at the slopes of the Leiter Hill encourage our vines to carry their origin within themselves. It is the deep roots of our vines that combine the soil of the Leiter Hill with the surrounding world. Quality, which is guaranteed by constant control and attention to detail from beginning to end. The latest cellar techniques that are based on centuries-old methods create a qualitative connection between yesterday, now, and tomorrow. It is the combination of old handcraft, attention to detail, and most of all, patience, which allow our vines to develop correctly. Many hands and hard work are needed to cultivate these vines with the care that they desire. They thank us with ripeness, profundity, and complexity. At Hillinger, we make motivation, origin, and lifeblood tasteable. Quality, community, consistency. This is Hillinger. Leo Hillinger, more than wine.
Well, this is kind of what it is all about. Leo has always told me it's more than just wine, the whole brand, and it's coming back. That's what happens to me usually too. So Paul, you've been working with Leo now for a couple of years, but you've been a neighbor. You grew up in Neusiedl am See, which is right next to Joyce. And I think you have seen Leo once and twice before you started working for him, right?
Yeah, right. Hello from my side. Also nice greetings from Austria. As Klaus said, I was growing up next to the town where Leo started his winery. And I've also known Leo for a long time before I started working with him. We had a small winery ourselves. And yeah, now since almost 2 years, I'm working with Leo. I'm responsible for the export and for some key account customers here in Austria. And it's been a nice journey, a really interesting journey. And I think it's, yeah, this is surely one of the most interesting wineries we have here in Burgenland, and also the most innovative and also Leo himself, he has a lot of, has had a lot of good ideas concerning wine and still has them. And yeah, we have some interesting products and I'm glad we can show you some of them today.
Yeah, I'm super excited because I go back to Leo's beginning, not really beginning, but when he first started to come to the United States, he built this beautiful little building right here. And I actually was traveling with him when he got the okay to build it in 2003. And in 2004, he already opened it. It took him not even a year to put this at that time, it was one of the most modern wineries in Europe, which he built inside of the mountain. So that I don't know if we have enough time in 1 hour, Antoinette, to tell everything I have to tell about Leo, but I will do my best to talk about this bigger than big man here from Austria. You know, this is the winery, and this is just pretty, it was one of his dreams because I met him in 2002. Actually, my wife met him. We were at the Vivinum in 2002 when Anton Bauer and I decided to expand the portfolio and bring in a few winemakers or wineries from Austria. And my wife picked out Leo Hillinger in the Burgenland room because maybe he was the loudest and the biggest and the tallest and the most people stood around him. You know, that it's always a good sign when a lot of people are around a table, something is there. And that really was the case with Leo Hillinger. And then I was really lucky because I actually stood him up for my first appointment and Seth from Vin Divino was there as well. And he almost grabbed him in front of me. So I was barely missed Leo to come on board with me, but then he came and it was quite difficult for him at the beginning because at that time in Austria, he was already very well known. But of course, 20 years ago, Austrian wine in the US was very little known and nobody knew Hillinger. So it was hard for him to come in. But as you will see in my presentation today, that challenge is just something Leo drives for. He likes challenge. That's all about his life story. It's consequence, consequence, consequence. That's his book, his title, and that's how he made it to where he is. So I know we are not tasting this wine today, but since Leo unfortunately had a couple other things going on because he is a multi a businessman now with quite a few businesses, but wine is his passion. But I'm going to try to bring him in to tell us about this Secco.
Hello, everybody. I'm Leo Hillinger, and this is my Secco. My Secco Rosé, made from the grapes Pinot Noir.
It's very windy in Burgenland, so bear with me with the sound.
The grapes are from very young wines. That's why, you know, there are a lot of nice fruit and acid. You know, if I have the wine strawberry, fresh harvest strawberry. And a little bit of lime. It's made in Burgenland. It's usually Burgenland is a very warm region. But we have a few hills, and from there comes a cold wind down to this vineyard, and that's why the drainage level is extremely rosé. This is made for everybody.
So, yeah, I hope you heard a little bit of it. And here we go. So Leo Hillinger, the Secco. I remember when he first showed me this wine, he took me into the cellar and he had this big crate and he had it covered up. And then he opened it up and say, damn, this is going to be incredible. That's the first time when he made this rosé from Pinot Noir. And he infused it with a little bit CO2, or not infused, it's kind of slowly injected. And he said, you have to be very fine. It's a process which takes a little bit longer to get the bubbles a little small. It's less expensive than champagne or the Medard Champenoise. So it's kind of the Prosecco Chamont method. and then people are going to love it. And Leo was so right. We sell, Nick, how much do we sell of that? A shitload.
As much as we can drink. You know, you put it in those wonderful little 187s. When you said we weren't drinking it tonight, I said, well, that's, you are not drinking it tonight. I'm always going to have it.
Yeah, it's all right. We don't need to really promote this, but I had to bring it on. And, you know, Leo Hillinger is a name in Austria, and it goes back. He actually is self-made. So what you see there, it's not, Leo didn't inherit anything. He always says that, you know, my dad left me with a few bank loans when I had to take over the business from my father. I actually started from below ground. We had 0.8 hectares of vineyards, and he kind of had to start paying back bank loans first, and that made him stronger, he said. And Leo kind of got his inspiration, and I just watched an interview with his mom. He did on Austrian TV before this taping again to refresh my memories. But Leo, when he was a teenager, his mom realized that him and his dad are not really getting along, because he was the oldest son. There was four children, and he had a younger brother, almost a twin. There was only like a year and a half apart. But since Leo was supposed to take over from his father, and his father was old school, Leo was just never doing things right for his dad. He was just always... They were getting into each other. And his mom said, I had to separate them, because Leo at that time, when he was 14 years old, he was a big boy, big guy. And his father was just not doing the right thing for him. So she found him an intern in Germany, where Leo found a boss who really embraced him. And then Leo went on a stipend to California from the Austrian wine marketing, where they were focusing on new young people, especially in Burgenland, to take over wineries. Because in the late 80s, 90s is when they really wanted to promote that area and find some new winemakers. And when Leo came back, he had some great ideas. And especially what he learned in California was like organic. He worked at Phelps and Schurk and looked around, and at that time, actually, he first drank wine from a Riedel glass, even though he's from Austria. But in Burgenland, they drink wine from the little small glass or the mug at that time, but not the kind of fine restaurant culture. You would have to go to Vienna for it. So anyway, here I'm going to bring in Paul. He can introduce Peter, who is now the winemaker for Leo. And I always have to be careful. Leo is the main winemaker. Peter is just making the wines with Leo. Isn't that correct, Paul?
This is exactly correct. Here we're seeing pictures. I think it was from your last bias trip, Klaus, when you were in Austria last year, or when it was still possible to travel. And on the left side, you see Peter. He is our cellar master, and he is a very, very genius guy. He started in Geisenheim, which is one of the most famous winery schools in Europe or in the whole world. And he's doing a really, really great job, and he gets along really good with Leo, because they have kind of the same ideas when it comes to promoting or to finishing off the wines, and how they should be grown, how they should be treated as vines, how they should be treated in the cellar. And so the focus is really on our bio-organic treatment in the vineyards. And then we try to keep it as simple as possible and really laid back in the cellar itself. So we let the wines develop their own sense of our regional style the wines have. So when you try Blaufränkisch, or we will try it later, or Pinot Noir from our area, you will know that this is from our area. So this is something Leo and Peter have in mind when they try to produce our wines. And here you see a little overview what this organic production means for us. You know, this organic production is not something we really and put up in with our marketing, but this is something like it's logical for us. For the wines we want to produce, the organic production of the wines is just logical for us. And so, yeah, you see some points, of course, which are given by the organic production. So we only use just a few spraying agents in the vineyards, which we are only allowed to use. And I think we'll see a picture of it later. And also we use the most modern technology, so we can keep it as low as possible. And also, of course, we have the vineyard soil is kept green all over the year. We plant different plants there for the bees, also for the soil to recover. So we don't use any artificial fertilizer. We can keep the soil healthy only with our greenkeeping over the year. This is something which is really important for us, because as wine growers, of course, the soil is one of the biggest treasures we have here in our area, of course. And we try to keep it as healthy as possible.
Leo has two children, and Leo Jr., Leo the third, already made his first wine.
Yeah.
Dad stayed out of it. He was able to do it completely by himself, wasn't he?
Yeah, Leo Jr. is now 19 years old. He has done his first wine, I think, 2 years ago. He got a small vineyard in really one of the best areas here in our area. So his dad really gave him a chance there, and he made a really, really good result. It was one white wine and one red wine, and they're turning out really fine. And he's now just finishing school, and he is already again back in the winery. This time he was now in the cellar for 2 or 3 weeks. Now he's on tour with me and my colleague in sales. So he's about to join the winery right now, and there will be also coming some new products from him as well in the near future.
That's great. And then I think his daughter is going to the hospitality industry, and there might even be a little Hillinger hotel in the works at one of these days down at the lake or close by.
Yeah.
And the big portfolio we have. Austria is a white wine country, but I'm sorry I have to disappoint you today, because today we are focusing on all red wines, but we are making some delicious white wines at the Leo Hillinger winery as well. But we are located in Burgenland. Of course, I always say east of Paris, near Vienna. So it's a little bit south of Vienna on the Lake Neusiedlersee is where you find the Hillinger winery in a little village called Jois. So here's the Burgenland. So Wien, Vienna, and you kind of an hour when Leo drives and when I drive, it takes about an hour and 15 minutes or so. It's about an hour from the airport. Straight shot going down to Jois, and that's where Burgenland is located. So here, a different picture. People always associate Austria with mountains and skiing. Burgenland, even so Leo is a very good skier. Burgenland doesn't have really mountains. There's the last hill of the Alps, which is the Leiterberg, which we'll be talking a little bit more about. But then when you go east, on the other side of the lake, especially, you go into the Pannonian flatlands, and there's no mountain, not even a hill in sight. So Burgenland, Neusiedlersee, we actually produce more red wine than white wine in Burgenland. So Neusiedlersee is kind of the northern part where Leo is located. Then we also have Mittelburgenland, and then Eisenberg is in the southern part of Burgenland. So we are more in the Neusiedlersee region here. Up on the top is where Paul comes from that village called Neusiedl am See. And then Jois is on that side of the lake, so the western part, which is right on the Leitergebirge. And here you see a picture looking down to Rust, onto the lake. And this is kind of the hills around Rust, where some of the top wines for this hill won. Well, we actually thank you, Antoinette, for picking two vintages of Hill One. I don't get many chances to drink the flagship wine, and today I actually get to drink two vintages. So thank you very much for doing that. But before we go to our top wine, we're going to bring in the Leiterberg. And the Leiterberg is really the best Blaufränkisch terroir in Austria. Of course, people in Eisenberg or some other places may have something to say about that. But if you talk to most professionals in the wine business, they feel like the Leiterberg is one or the best area for Blaufränkisch. But also the Burgundy grapes do extremely well on the Leiterberg because of the soil with the schist, and because that used to be an ocean or coast, we have a lot of chalk and limestone. So Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and Weißburgunder do very, very well on the Leiterberg. And here you see the vineyard right across from the winery on the other side, on the foot of the Leiterberg. And actually all the Pinot Noir and the white grapes are usually planted closer to the forest, because it's a little cooler. You got the cool air coming down at nighttime and sometimes get a little shade. And then the Blaufränkisch, which likes the sun, is in the center. And this is all south-facing vineyards. And just amazing stuff there. So our tasting order, before I bring Paul back to talk about the Pinot Noir, if you are ready, we're starting with the Pinot Noir first. You can pour yourself a glass. And then we're doing the Leiterberg, the Blaufränkisch. Then the third wine is going to be the Hillside, which is the blend. We're going then more to international style of. And then we're finishing with the two vintages of the Hill One, which is the flagship for Leo Hillinger. So I bring you back, Paul, and you can... we just also on the same line as the Pinot Noir, we make a Pinot Gris as well, where we actually have a little change in label color. We just changed it from this gold kind of looking to white to, I think, hopefully it's just arriving very soon, the 2019 vintage Pinot Gris. And but today we are doing Pinot Noir. Leo and is tasting here the Pinot Gris with his cellar master, correct?
Yeah, this picture looks like it was taken right behind, right after harvest. Like the wine looks like in the glass. And so now we're tasting our Pinot Noir, Evelyn. And I think this is a really good start into our red wines because it's really nice, that style of the wine, this nice elegance, a little bit structured, the different kind of dark berries in the nose. It's a really typical Pinot Noir for our area in this house. Told you, normally in the Burgenland, we are more on the red wine side, but as you've seen in the Leitergebirge or the Leiterberg, you have all those forests in the background or on the top of the hills. And this is really good for the acidity in the wine. So normally we are highly influenced by Pannonian climate with really dry, really hot summers over like 2 months in July and August. And so the cool winds from the forest, especially during the nights, are really good for especially grapes like Pinot Noir and also the white wine varieties, the Burgundy varieties, to keep a nice acidity still in the grapes. And they bring a really nice structure into these wines, and especially for Pinot Noir, this is important. And I think it comes really, really out in this wine. So this is also something you can keep on stock for a few years, for 10, 15 years, and it still will be fresh to drink, still will have a nice structure on the plate. It still will be fun to drink. So this is our Pinot Noir. The name Pinot Noir Evelyn, I think Klaus can tell you a little fun story about how this wine came to mind with him and Leo.
Yeah, I had to find out the hard way about how it ages. The story goes back that, I'm gonna come back to this picture in a minute, but maybe the next one shows Evelyn. So this is Leo's wife. Says this is my love of my life after my mother. He's very much in love with Evelyn. I remember when they got married in 2006. She is actually from the Wachau, but she doesn't come from a winery family. But she really brought some softness into Leo's life. He was really working hard and traveling and all this, and she came into his life and also gave him two wonderful children, which he's a very wonderful father, and very engaged with his children, but he's not pushing them. I guess he learned his mistakes his father made, and he wants to do better for his children. But Evelyn, the story goes that in 2005 vintage, I went to his cellar and tasted a tank. I think it was our last visit, and we visited like four wineries throughout the day. So I probably already had a couple of glasses too many when I came to Leo's winery. And we tasted through all his tanks and we came to this Pinot Noir tank. And I like, shit. And it was just about when that Sideways movie was out. And I said, Leo, if I can sell this Pinot for about $20 or so in the US, I'll sell the whole tank. And Leo looked at me and I guess he thought that I was a little bit drunk or something like that. So he was, you know, he was not just jumping up and down right away. But anyway, the night went on and we were talking. And by the end of the night, I guess we made a deal because a few months later, I got a phone call and Leo was telling me that my Pinot Noir is ready. And I kind of stuttered a little bit, and you see Leo's a big guy, and you know, I didn't want to say no to him or something like this, so I kind of questioned myself into that story, and I said, and finally I found out that I bought on that day I bought 6,000 liters of Pinot Noir. Whew. First Pinot Noir ever from Austria, 6,000 liters. So I had to think very quickly, and I knew how in love he was with Evelyn, so I said, you know, we should give it a name. I know it's from a couple different vineyards and you know, just Pinot Noir Burgenland. Why don't we just ask Evelyn if we can use her name on the wine? Because I knew that was for me a security blanket. And since I was not in Austria and I didn't remember 6,000 liters, but if he would ever send me something which is not up to the quality, I can always call Evelyn and then say, Evelyn, go taste your wine. It's not what it's supposed to be. And I know Leo would make sure. And I've never had to call Leo in all these years, but it took me, I think, 3 years to sell the first 6,000 liters. It took a while, but we sold it all. And thanks, Evelyn. I think, Nick, I have to say thank you, too, because you helped me a lot selling this wine.
It was an absolute pleasure to drink this wine because, you know, we for so often the kind of pillars of the Pinot Noir community were Burgundy on one side, California on the other side. Oregon snuck in there somewhere in between, having more fruit than Burgundy, but not quite as much as California. And then along came Leo's Pinot, and it had a wonderful amount of fruit to it, but never to the point where it got jammy or sweet. It always maintained that wonderful traditional Burgundian kind of fruit structure to it. But it wasn't as earthy or green as you might expect. It definitely was an about face from all of the Pinot Nero and stuff you would see from places like Italy. And so it snuck right in there, right into the sweet spot of what everybody who was drinking Pinot was looking for. Something that was a little bit bigger, had some great richness to it, wonderful layers, still had that cool climate fruit that made it very drinkable, and that acidity that made it match up with everything. It's just a really amazing bottle of wine. And when you consider, as you pointed out, how everybody was going bonkers for Pinot over Sideways, for what Leo is able to do for this price, it's a steal.
Well, it's a fight every year to keep the price about the same, because of course every year a winery tells me it costs more money and the glass is more expensive and the capsule are more expensive and my workers are more expensive. But we have really been able to keep that wine at around the same price point all these years. And I want to say thank you, Paul, and thank you, Leo, for continue bringing us such a great Pinot Noir. And this is, you know, some French clones we have here. Altenberg, like I mentioned, this is right across from the winery. And, you know, this is top notch. He also makes even a higher level of Pinot Noir. So this is kind of the little earlier harvest. And then we have some young vineyards where he makes the Secco from. But as they are getting older, hopefully our production of the Evelyn will go up a little bit as well, and we can sell even more of this quality Pinot Noir. And that's kind of our goal to go there. And it's like Nick said, it's light-footed, but it's not light. It's a lot of fruit, but it's not sweet either. It's not that Coca-Cola sweetness you get sometimes in New World Pinot Noirs, because it has the acidity. And a lot of times in the Bourgogne or in the Burgundy, the grapes who make it into the entry-level Bourgogne in that price point are not as high quality as these are. So this is kind of a really, really great bottle. So Pinot Noir from Austria, You know, the monks in the 11th century already brought the grapes from the Clos de Vougeot over to Austria, and we're on the same latitude. We got the limestone, we got the chalk. So we got some of the same classic areas, but we have a bit more sunshine. So we have to be very careful with climate change to treat the Pinot Noir correctly and have it close enough to the forest. And even sometimes we plant it now in like north facing vineyards. So here actually you see the vineyard, Altenberg, right across where the clones are. And as I mentioned,
keeping night, but also you have hot days.
Very windy. So I just had to bring in Peter for a second because he's so into, just very much into it. And it's just unbelievable to see him. And this is picture I really want to show you is what Leo did to make a more tensa vineyard. He actually planted two vines together because of course the vineyard was planted a while ago. And at those times our tractors were still quite larger than we have them now. So the vineyards are planted a bit more spacious apart, but by planting two vines together, he got a really good density. And those vines have to fight a little bit more. And then from this part of this vineyard now, he makes what he calls the terroir, or pretty soon we're actually gonna call it the Altenberg, a single vineyard Pinot Noir, vineyard. Which is coming out. What vintage will be the first one? Or is that decided already? Or
This is not decided already, but I think we are going a little bit more in this direction of producing single vineyard wines and also the DSC wines, which we'll be tasting afterwards with our Blaufränkisch. Because especially with vineyards like this, where you have wines which are 25 years, 30 years old, and have a limited yield, this is something which really gives off a nice flavor, a nice impression of our terroir where we are growing our wines. So we are heading a little bit more in this direction of those single vineyard wines and DSC wines. I think it will be maybe around vintage 2018 or something like that.
Yeah, so here you see the vineyard again, very high. This I think I took in June or something like this. I was in Austria during a Vivinum. So of course you see all organic vineyard mentioned with the crop in between. It's all green. And Altenberg, beautiful vineyard. Terroir, Pinot Noir is the one we make now from that single vineyard here. And there is a little, the newer tractors, the newer vineyards are planted a little bit closer together now. And these are high-tech tractors. And even so, with organic production, you have to go more often to do the preparations. There is so much high-tech on these tractors, Paul, right? Peter is explaining us.
Here this is something Peter, as I told you, or as Klaus already said, he's a really energetic guy. He's a little bit like a genius minded when it comes to those technological stuff. And although we are producing bio-organic wine, I think it's also important to really go with technology, and it's helping us a lot with producing our organic wines. Because, for example, where you see the sprayer on the, you don't see the tractor because it's standing behind the one in front. But the tractor, which is attached to the sprayer, it's really up to the latest technology. You can control the speed. The tractor knows exactly how much it has to spray. It's returned on this vessels on the side that the spray is returned and reused. So we don't use a drop. Not a drop goes away with the wind where it shouldn't go. And this is something we are really trying to implement in our organic production, because you need modern technology to produce good, high quality wines. And especially with organic production in our area, you have to be really careful that you don't get any mold into the wines. You need to use technology, but of course also a lot of handwork when it comes to the leaf management in the wines itself. You use also a lot of handwork. So it's a nice combination of both.
Yeah. And you have weather stations in between and the computer generated, and that tractor knows exactly when to go out, and you don't go out if you don't have to. And they're also very light. You actually can take the air out and they're not pressing down. They're actually becoming
They can push out the air of the tires when they drive into the vineyard. So you have a little bit more space where the tire is resting on the ground, so you don't have that high pressure on our green soil. And when they get back on the street to drive, they pump back the air and they can be driving the street. So they're really up to the latest technology.
It's just amazing. So here, you know, sustainable, organic, we're doing all this. Austria is a leading place in Europe for the amount of wineries. I think we might even be the leading place with how much organic agricultural, and especially in the vineyards, we have a 15% right now, organic biodynamic vineyards. We have a lot of Demeter, and then even we have our own, some of the producers got together and they call it Respect. And then we have also called the certified sustainable. And Leo has the certification from the European organic production. And now I have to go back a few years to my grandfather, to the Shalomon time. Really is responsible to bring grape growing to the East. When he took over from the Romans actually kind of didn't allow for grapes to be grown there because they wanted to, even so the soldiers, they were paid with wine, but at the Roman times, we're not quite 100% sure if they actually had vineyards up there too. But Shalomon then brought grape growing to the East, to east of Austria, Hungary, and Burgenland actually used to be Hungary, and now it's Austria. And that's also he's the father of Blaufränkisch, because all the good grapes, he put an Isch on the back, and Heunisch is one of the mother grapes for Blaufränkisch. And that is our main grape in Austria. And then in 1862, it was first mentioned as Blau, blue, and then Franken, Shalomon, and Isch, because of the Isch from the Heunisch, the mother grape. And here you see, it's actually in the top vineyards, it's actually even smaller. And there's a lot of, a little bit looks almost sometimes like Pinot Noir, but it's a very thick, much thicker skin. Lots of tannins you can get in the Blaufränkisch. And it really takes on the vineyard, the terroir, where it's grown in. So it's just an amazing grape variety for this part of Austria, which is, people don't think of us as a red wine country and a late ripening grape, but this is just really perfect there. And we used to try, when we first started, you know, it's Austria, I always call it the new kid in the old world. So we looked how wines are made in France, in Bordeaux, in Spain or California. And we used to put the Blaufränkisch into the small barrels, barrique barrels, and aged it in there. And I must admit, I never liked the Blaufränkisch when I first started this business 20 years ago, because the Blaufränkisch in the 90s. And so that small barriques also concentrate any kind of green flavors. So if you didn't get the Blaufränkisch 100% ripe, then it always was stemmy and green. And we're realizing now, and many other wineries around the world also realizing, that the old people, or like they used to make wine, they were not that stupid. And actually the big barriques for certain grapes are actually much better than the small new French oak wines. And Blaufränkisch is one of those grapes which really enhances much more so when you put it in these Stockinger, which is actually an Austrian cooperage. And if you go to Tuscany, and if you go to Spain or even France, you will find Stockinger barrels in some of the top cellars. So here again, Peter takes us through the cellar, high-tech, temperature-controlled fermentation, but then the wine ages in these big, big barrels. We're going to pour us the next wine. We're going to the Leiterberg. And Paul, I will bring you back to talk about the Leiterberg.
Yeah, so the next wine is our Blaufränkisch Leiterberg DSC. It's vintage 2016. As Klaus mentioned before, and the Blaufränkisch you have seen on the picture, the grape here, and we are using really, really old clones of Blaufränkisch for our wines. So our grapes look a little bit more, they're a little bit bigger than a closed fist, and really dense, have a thick berry where they can accumulate a lot of flavor, a lot of color in those. And especially in our area where we have the Pannonian climate, varieties like Blaufränkisch, they have the time to really mature on the vines. They can grow physiologically fully ripe. We can harvest them with a really nice level of sugar and acidity, which gives off a really nice flavor in the wines and make them perfect harmonic. I think this wine now is at a really, really good drinking age with vintage 2016. And as Klaus said, when the red wine boom was in Austria 10, 15 years ago, everybody tried to try those little small barrique barrels, the French oak barrels, also with the Austrian autochthone varieties like Blaufränkisch. And of course, you have the toasted barrels, which give off a flavor themselves. And so we try really to leave the Blaufränkisch alone after harvest. They are spontaneously fermented in these wooden casks from Stockinger, from the Austrian barrels. And then we leave it the time it takes. And we can't really say when we will be bottling or when we will be moving the wine from the barrel into the bottle, because this is a process over 2 or 3 years. And Leo and Peter are tasting the wines all the time when it will be the right time to bring the wine into the bottle. And I think this went really well with this year. And the 2016 is a really nice, typical Austrian Blaufränkisch. Also, I would call it nearly a cool climate Blaufränkisch, because it's also from vineyards really close to the forest. There's a nice cool climate and also, I think, a nice structure on a plate.
Well, it has freshness.
And a really nice freshness, yes.
Yeah.
And this is also something, and I think also with the Pinot Noir, both of those wines have a really nice power. You feel really powerful on the plate when you drink them, but they don't get too heavy. They don't get creamy. They don't get bored when you drink them. They still have a nice vivid structure on the plate and you're keen for a second glass of it. You don't have this full mouth after one glass. You're really keen for really looking forward to your second glass of these wines.
Nick, if I bring you in here, Paul, you may want to turn your volume down. That's a little back sound. But Nick, from an Italian importer side, having a few Barolos in your portfolio, doesn't this Blaufränkisch take you a little bit to the Nebbiolo?
You know, I think this wine straddles style classification, which is one of the reasons why it's always caught my eye. You know, there is that red fruited aspect that can definitely lean towards the cool climate Nebbiolos and the Barolos, but again, it doesn't have that intense tannic grippiness that sometimes is off-putting for some people when they talk about the Nebbiolo grape. But at the same time, there is a strength and a grace and a power to this wine, which I loved when I was in the wine shops, throwing it at people that loved Chateauneuf du Pape, because it's got that red fruited aspect, but again, that richness and that body that people who love Chateauneuf du Pape want that plus a little bit of spice. Here is something that gives you all those things in a familiar vein. But again, being Blaufränkisch and from the Leithenberg with that high iron content, it gives you some different flavors that really, really stand out. And there's always that little spicy kind of pencil lead graphite aspect in this wine that I think is incredibly attractive and really
makes
the wine for me with all.
It has that earthy tone, like a Syrah, like you said, Chateauneuf du Pape, Rhone, and almost Hermitage-like, but then it has that light-footedness like a Pinot Noir. It has that freshness of the Pinot Noir. And you are not one of those people, but some of my importers and people keep asking me, you know, when is the new vintage? When are you going to bring out the new vintage? And I like, why do you want a new vintage? This wine is still improving. Why do we want to bring something out which is not ready? And I think just now, and I don't want to say thank you to COVID for anything, but it has helped us as Austrian wine country a lot to keep things a little bit back. And now we are able to come out with certain wines when they're supposed to come out. And we're not pushing them on the market like we always do, because people always want the fresh, the new stuff, the newest. And I know I'm going to be drinking this wine. I just had a 2011 a few days ago. Those are just wines. Buy a six pack at least. Drink one or two bottles if you have to, and then put a few back and buy some more, because you probably need more. in 5 or 6, 7 years. When you never, you're not going to be able to find some more, unless you go with me to Austria and Paul will take us to Leo's wine cellar, because I hear Leo puts some wine to the side for himself, right?
He's a really nice archive of his wines, yes.
He loves all the wines, and I know I'm talking too much and we're going way back over time now already, but this is really the soil. This is what it's all about. That's the schist. The vines have to grow through all this because the water runs through, and vines always have to grow as far down till they find water. That's how vines grow. And going through all this, you know, schist, there's almost a little iron thing in there, and that's why you get all these flavors. And they're really stressed, so they're small berries, but these berries, you know, this is the schist. But then underneath, we actually have chalk, kalk, and limestone. And that's kind of the home. And then we have certain vineyards when you come closer to the lake, which have a lot of sand. And that's actually a little bit like left, right bank. You got the Merlot, and also Zweigelt likes the sand quite a bit. And actually, when we go to our top cuvée, it's actually 50% Merlot, where Leo has close to the river some unbelievable vineyards which grow Merlot extremely well. So here's Leo with his flagship wine, kind of the bottle he needs to drink. You know, we are drinking the little smaller ones, but Leo is able to drink the 3 liter himself, which I have seen him do in his heydays. But before we go to the hill one, this hillside kind of was developed by Paul's predecessor. Some of you may remember Michael, who used to come from the restaurant business and worked with Leo through the last financial crisis in 2009, when the stock market kind of fell. We were, you know, have your top wine, and Leo really built the brand with the Hill One in Austria. But of course, people, when you cannot lower the price, that's kind of the thing, because if you once go down, it's very difficult to back up. So they decided to develop a new wine, which calls Hillside. And the Hill One used to be a wine which blended actually Cabernet and some international grapes in it. But Leo found that sticking more to the Merlot, but also the Austrian grapes, and keeping it between the two Austrian grapes and Merlot, it's better for the Hill One. And he was left with incredible vineyard of Syrah. So 60% Syrah in this wine, blended with a little bit Zweigelt, because of course we have to make it an Austrian wine, and just take a little bit from that Hill One Merlot to put it in there. So Nick or Paul, go right ahead and tell me a little bit what you think when you taste this wine while I pour myself a glass.
Yeah, as Klaus already told them, this wine was nearly specially developed, I would say, for the gastronomy or for restaurants, because it's a wine which is really well fitting to a lot of different dishes, a lot of different situations. The wine itself suits really well to pour by the glass. It's in a nice price range to do it, to pour it by the glass, and it's also really suitable for a lot of dishes. The Syrah, it's more like the international type of wine we have in our winery, or as the style of wine we have in our winery. We tasted before the Blaufränkisch DSC, which is really typical for our area. This is now a little bit more of the international style with a lot of Syrah in it. Also really nice spiciness, a lot of blackberries, raspberries, cherries from the Zweigelt part of it, and a really nice structure, but not a really nice round finish, I think, really harmonic finish. And it's just nice to drink. And we also have a Hillside White since a few years, which is quite the counterpart to the red one. And we sell them really well here in Austria in the restaurants, and also in Germany, because these wines are in a nice price range and are really drinkable just by the glass.
Yeah, you guys always want to sell more wine. Yeah. Let's stick to what we have. Hillside really over delivers for the price point, I think. People don't associate Austrian wine with red wine, especially not this style of red wine. but it's not manufactured. It's still manually, it's organic. It's from some of the best vineyards between Altenberg and actually there's a little bit in Rust, where some of the top vineyards are located there. Nick, we're quite successful with this, right? When you show it.
I love this wine because it, once again, shows Austria's ability to flex itself into whatever style of wine they need to create for whatever type of wine drinker that's out there. This one is the counterpunch to Argentinian Malbec and California big-bodied, big fruity wines, because with that backbone of Syrah, it delivers a really strong black fruit punch as far as it goes on the palate. But it, again, has a lightness because of that Zweigelt being in there and that Merlot for structure. It really just, everything works in perfect balance. And I think that's the thing more than anything else. When you have these overfruited high extraction wines, you know, they taste great on the first sip, but without the structure to carry through, you know, you don't want to have a second glass. And yet this is a hook that absolutely, it delivers on the fruit, on the spice, on the finish, and it keeps re-delivering that until the bottle's all gone. So you can't help but fall in love with this. If you have a bunch of those friends who like, you know, big monster California cabs or odd Argentinian Malbecs, this is a great wine to show them what you can do if you're not going for, you know, that mega purple, you know, type of wine. Instead, if you do your work in the vineyard and get great fruit, you're going to end up with an even better wine, and you can still appeal to all those people that have one taste bud.
Yeah, and this is kind of right behind the winery, the little terrace. So if you come to Austria, Leo Hillinger, actually, you can visit the winery. And if you don't make it out to the winery, if you're just in Vienna, we actually have some wine stores. Actually, I forgot to put some pictures in there of the Hill lounges. But Leo always actually decided he wants to do direct to the customers. So he actually has his own wine stores in Vienna, in Kitzbühel, in Munich. And he had one in Salzburg too, and then one at the outlet center, which is very close to the winery. So people can buy the wines at the half up Hof price, and he goes direct to the consumer. But still, in the restaurants, you can find, and that hillside is just a great steakhouse, steak wine, everyday red. So Zweigelt is the Austrian second grape variety after Blaufränkisch. Little bit softer. It's actually mother grape is the Blaufränkisch, and it was crossed with St. Laurent, which is in the Pinot Noir family, and it was by Lenz Moser. Then after World War II era, it was planted all over Austria because it's a high yielding grape. But now we are making some lower yields, and Zweigelt actually we're finding it in a lot of blends. It makes some very beautiful, everyday drinking, easy wines with no tannins, but it's also a great, great blending grape, which you just saw in the hillside, and you will see it now in the Hill One as well, because 25% of this top cuvée is Zweigelt, and this is actually Leo, how he developed his brand. When he came back from California and he had to take over from his dad's the dealership. I mean, he was like a wine dealer and didn't own any vineyards. Leo purchased some of the best juice available and made this wine and gave it this beautiful modern looking label. This label is quite old. Leo had a great marketing firm in Linz, which developed this brand for him when he started out. And Leo actually sold this wine at the golf course. He did tastings. Leo also was a hardworking person. He went to restaurants sometimes 20, 30, 40, 50 times, came in the front door, was thrown out, and then he walked into the back door. And then after 25, 30 visits, the sommelier finally said, you know, I cannot get rid of you, so let me just buy something from you. And then they bought this wine, and then the customers really loved it. And that's how Leo really developed this brand from the get-go. And it's hardworking. So let's pour ourselves a glass and see how this tastes. And Paul or Nick, tell us a little bit what you taste.
Maybe let me start off again. And I think as Klaus said, this was like the wine which really helped to kick off the Hillinger brand, or the rise of the Hillinger winery when Leo took over the wine. It's now a blend of, or I think since 2013, it's a blend of Merlot, Blaufränkisch, and Zweigel. Biggest part is the Merlot, but I think when you smell into the glass, yeah, it's a really nice mix of blackcurrant, cherries.
I can't wait till people say, I smell Burgenland. I know it's a few years out to get there. I mean, right now, being a French, and I worked in a French restaurant for so many years, I smell Bordeaux. I smell Merlot, basically, you know, really top-notch, Saint-Emilion, Pomerol. But
I think that's the thing, right away on the nose, you know, this wine grabs you and says there's, you know, we just had a bunch of really delicious and amazing wines. And yet from first smell and first sip, you know that this is a different higher level, even above everything else that we've been enjoying so far. It stands out for good reason.
Well, it's very low yield. It's some of the best vignettes, you know, in Uckau and also down in Rust. Umriss is one of those vignettes. If you look at these single vignettes, some of the Blaufränkisch stuff coming out and top wines from Burgenland, these are the top vineyard sites where Leo was able. He actually was thrown because he was Hasiberry. It was a guy who was his vineyard manager for many, many years, and he almost wanted to build the winery in Rust, but then his home is in Joyce. And it's quite a distance with a tractor. It takes a long time to travel the distance. But he had some great things also where his home in Joyce is, but then he had this opportunity to take over because Hasiberry didn't have any children, wanted to take over. So he stayed on. He actually bought everything from him, but he stayed on for many. How many years? He just retired a few years ago, right, Paul?
I think it's just like 6 to 8 years, something like that, 5-6 years.
Yeah, I remember this guy coming in during the harvest, yeah. And you know, Leo and him were on the phone.
This is something now, and we said with like every wine, you know, this is from the best vineyards, but this is something which is really true because Leo had a really nice feeling for these things for a long time, like when it started. And it is true that we have either on the northern side of the lake and on the west side of the lake, it's everywhere on the best sites. It's the Leo Hillinger wineries, or the vineyards. So this is something which is nearly true for all of our wines, that they are from the best sites. And I think in this wine, you can really feel it. And also only the best barrels come into the Hill One. And yeah, I think it's really, really nice to drink right now.
And you have to understand, Austria is a little bit like the Burgundy or the French system, where children inherit the same amount and vineyards are split up. But then a lot of times they are not want to go into the wine business. So somebody with being quite successful as Leo Hillinger is, sometimes he can pay a little bit more money than another small winery who really would love to get this vineyard because it's next to theirs. But Leo was able to really purchase some strategic top vineyard sites as he grew and got more successful. By actually developing one side of his business, which he entertains a lot of the everyday consumer wines. And, you know, he's a big winery. But at the same time, he never lost sight of the top quality wines and getting wines from the best vineyards, and especially his Hill One. I mean, this is always his baby. That's the wine. And we have done quite a few blind tastings. And Hill One always comes in at wines, and it's not cheap. I mean, this is not an inexpensive Austrian wine. By all means, it can't be cheap because you can't make it that good. It would be manufactured. This is the real stuff. So let me pour a little bit of the 2003 because I'm really excited. And I actually had to work very hard on this bottle because I know I had it standing a little bit too long and the cork was a little bit dry. And as soon as I put the corkscrew in, my cork fell apart, but the wine is delicious. Nick.
Klaus and Paul, could we talk maybe a little bit more of what Paul touched on very briefly with how Hill One is made from the best barrels? I mean, so many times winemakers often say, you know, we took our best 5% or our best 10%, but the level that Hillinger goes through to legitimately pick their best barrels, I think is a great story that's worth telling.
Yeah, this is something also Leo and also our cellar master are really behind, because often, as you say, especially the French tonneleries, they try to keep the best barrels in France, of course, for their customers. But we have some really good connections and are working with a nice tonnelery. So we only use French oak barrels for our wines. It's also with the toasting, we only use light, the maximum medium toasting. So we don't want to get the woods too involved into the wine. You also see it here with the Hill One, we use only about 1/3 of really new first filling barrels. And the other ones are up to fourth, fifth fillings of the barrels. So it's also, I think, when you try the wine in the first impression, also in the nose, you don't really get the hint of the wood or from the oak in the nose. So the smokiness is nearly gone in this wine, but you feel it on the plate that it's this nice micro-oxidation you have from the barrels. And this is what it's all about, you know, to find the right balance, that the wood gives off a nice structure, a nice tannin to the wine, but it shouldn't be up front. It should always be the wine up front, because especially, unfortunately, I couldn't get my hands on a bottle of 2013 because it would be in Leo's private archive and we couldn't get, I couldn't get one bottle, but especially when the wines are ripening or getting older, when you have too much wood in the wines, you only feel the wood after a long period of time because the fruitiness is building back a little bit. It gets a little bit more darker in aromatics. And I think with this one, with the 2015, you have also this nice like dark plums in the nose, or a little bit of more dried fruits, a little bit dark dried fruits in the nose. And so this is really important that you keep the wood really in the back and only for supporting the wine.
Well, I must say, you know, we're doing these little small barriques for the Merlot and some of the Zweigel top ways. And the way how they do it, actually, I mean, the winemaker Leo and Peter, they know the best barrels and they know when to harvest the best fruit. And they taste the wines for the 2 years they're in the barrel all the time. But the actual blind cuvée, they actually do it blind. They actually, Peter goes out there and takes from each barrel and then they taste it separate and then they blend it together and then see which work best together. And that's really, sometimes when we have a really good vintage, the hillside gets a little leftover from the top wines too. So it's great. And I am so happy that I still had a bottle of the 2013. Sorry, Paul, you in Austria, you cannot have it, but I'm in America and I have the 2013. And I don't know, Nick, if you had a bottle of 2013 or not.
I don't know which one I like better, because I'm such an Uber fan of everything that happened in 2015, and they're some of my favorite bottles. So I think I'm leaning slightly to the 15 right now, but that 13 does have that the beginnings of that ethereal quality of what happens when you lay wines down, where they just start to pay you back for your patience. And I will admit, now that I've opened my 13, it's one of those ones that I think I should have waited. This wine has so much life to it. It's beautiful. It's drinking great. You could absolutely enjoy it right now, but my head is just thinking it's still going to go on. There, I cannot see an end to this wine. It's just so well done.
I know I don't have any more 13 in my warehouse. I know your report shows both 13 and 15. I'm going to go there tomorrow and I'm going to go through it. Every 13 is left, I'm going to take it. So I know I went way too late, way too long, a little bit over the time limits here. So I say thank you. I thank you, Paul, for staying up.
Thank you very much.
And I'm going to give this back to Antoinette to close this out and see if there's any questions.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Yes, the 2013 came from our private collection. So I believe we have one bottle available for sale, but really it was just to show how these wines are capable of aging. And while we were bottling, we couldn't believe how youthful and fresh that 13 was. I mean, that's just amazing. Side by side, 15, 13, when the bottles were freshly opened, there was not that much of a difference.
When it breathes, that 13 is just opening up.
Yep. Wow.
Spectacular wines, really.
I know what I'm drinking tonight.
Yeah. Well, thank you for this incredible presentation and introduction to the estate. Paul, Klaus, and Nick, any final thoughts before we say goodnight?
Well, I make it quick. Keep drinking Austrian wines, Hillinger wines, and I'll be back a couple more times.
Yeah, I also say thank you very much for having us tonight or for giving us the chance to introduce our wines to you. And if you have the chance to go with Klaus on one of his bias trips, we're more than happy to welcome you here in Austria at our winery or at one of our shops. Not only we sell wines there, we also have a really nice hospitality there with where you can drink wine, enjoy some food. So if you get the chance to come to Austria, we're more than welcome to.
I think if I'm going to add anything else, it's that we've learned that, you know, the late 2000s have produced some incredible Austrian wines, and we've seen that in the Gruner Veltliners from 2019. So drinking these reds from Hillinger and knowing that those 19s are in the future coming, the future looks really great for the Hillinger Winery and everything that we're going to be able to try. So if you have not had the pleasure of drinking Leo's wines, get in now, because when we have some of the best vintages that have ever been made coming down the pipe, you're going to be mad if you missed out. So Paul, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Klaus, as always, I can't thank you enough for introducing me to these wines. And Antoinette, an amazing host. Thank you so much. Prost.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining. Again, thank you for joining us today, Paul, Klaus, and Nick. For those viewing, we appreciate your interest in the great wines of Austria. We encourage you to visit our website calendar at corkandfork.co to view the upcoming Austrian wine events we have with some of the region's greatest producers, such as our guest this evening. So once again, have a wonderful night. Thanks for joining us. I'm going to end the meeting for all. Good night, everyone. Bye.